Hi, Counties. This is Zari calling from New Rochelle, New York, and you're listening to Counter Programming with Shira and Arielle.
Hi, Counties. How goes it? Welcome to Counter Programming with us, Shira and Arielle.
We're here with your weekly dose of coronavirus news distraction, and coronavirus is still happening despite what all of the news is saying. Shira is nodding her head. If you're new here, welcome to your new favorite distraction cast, and if you're a longtime county, we are glad to have you back.
If you're binging this show and expected to hear an episode about Count Olaf, a warning that we switch things up a little bit. We promise to deliver you Count Olaf VV soon. But we've got quite the episode for you today, and we just couldn't wait to share it. People counters, aka the census, is our topic of the week. And we've got an incredible guest on today's show, Devera Cohn, a census expert, aka a professional people counter.
You like a professional people counter? I thought it was like people eat, purple people eater.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I like the alliteration. It's good.
Okay, good, good, good. Counties, we'd love to hear from you about counter topics that you'd like for us to explore. You can send us an email at counterprogrammingshiraarielle@gmail.com, or you can always slide into our DMs on Instagram at counterprogrammingpod. Wee, that's you on the slide.
Oh, me on the slide. In response to the political and social unrest as a result of the killing of George Floyd and countless other Black people by police brutality, we are raising money for the Equal Justice Initiative. Leave this podcast a review on Apple Podcasts and we'll donate $2 per review to EJI. All you have to do is go to Apple Podcasts, search for Counter Programming with Shira and Arielle, leave a rating and a review. That's it. We'll count them up at the end of each week and make a donation.
It may seem like the news has kind of stopped talking about it and fewer people are using the hashtag Black Lives Matter. We are still thinking about it every day. Shira and I are reading, we're listening to podcasts, and we're donating, and we want you to stay in this fight as well. This is a time where we can make real change, and we want to make sure that we're keeping up the momentum.
Before we get into this week's show, let's do a pulse check. Arielle, how are you?
I am okay. I'm having tough but necessary conversations with family and friends about white privilege and what it means to defund the police. It's been interesting having conversations with friends who I haven't spoken to in a long time about what exactly it means to defund the police and to abolish the police system. And it's been interesting for me that 2 weeks ago, before I'd really heard the terminology before, I was scared of the word abolish as it relates to defunding the police or getting rid of the police system as we know it. But now I'm all for it. Burn it all to the ground, baby. Shira, how are you?
Okay. Completely agree with everything you said. I've been having some awesome conversations with people who reached out to me on Instagram that I haven't spoken to in a while. And I love that the conversations feel like they have so much more meaning now than they usually do. And I've been reading a lot. Right now I'm reading How to Be Anti-Racist for a book club that I recently joined, and The Vanishing Half, which was my first book from Book of the Month that was a birthday gift for me. So that was really fun. Yeah, I just feel like I have been learning and realizing a lot of things about my privilege that I should have known for a long time, but it's been a very eye-opening. And in other news, my brother and I attempted to make gluten-free challah, which did not work. It was way, it actually tasted good, but it was way too sticky. We couldn't roll it. So we just like lumped it into a loaf. So, you know, always important to try new things, even if you fail.
Well, now that we have checked in, let's get into our episode. This is the moment that we've been waiting for. Let's count some people, counties. This is our episode on the census. We are so excited, but I want to relate this to the larger conversation that we're having. And Devera Cohn, who is our interviewee for the day, she will talk a little bit about this, but I want to draw the line very explicitly right now. And we want to just say this strong off the front. The census is super important. We want to make sure all communities get counted, not just the white communities who are historically very good at filling out the census. We want to make sure that people know that filling out the census wherever you live is super important. It helps you get the representation you need at a local level and at a larger U.S. representative level. Shira, tell us a little bit about when people can fill out the census until.
So I looked online at the 2020census.gov website, and originally you had until July 31st for the self responses, but they've actually revised the schedule because of COVID. And so you have until October 31st, but the sooner the better. Get that in. You don't want to forget.
And then you can dress up like a census enumerator for Halloween.
I'm sure that's why they chose the date.
We will get to that episode, and we are on purpose teasing it for a long time because the episode is amazing. But Shira, will you first tell us about the definition of the census?
Of course. A census is an official count or enumeration of members of a population, not necessarily human, usually residents or citizens in a particular region, often done at regular intervals. Though for our purposes, we're focusing on people counters.
And because the word census is an old one with a rich etymological history, we wanted to include that here. It's a word from the 1610s in reference to registration and taxation in Roman history. From Latin census, the enrollment of the names and property assessments of all Roman citizens, originally past participle of censere, to assess, the modern use of census as official enumeration of the inhabitants of a country or state with details begins in the U.S. in 1790, as De Vera will tell us, and revolutionary France in 1791. Property for taxation was the primary purpose in Rome, hence Latin census, also used for one's wealth, one's worth, wealthiness. It has changed since, but it's good to know that it was rooted in land-owning people, you know, the privileged, wealthy class.
In a moment, we're going to introduce you to our expert of the day, De Vera Cohn, who has some incredible knowledge to share with us about the history, present, and future with the census. But before we start, Ariel, I feel like you should tell the counties about your experience with the census and why you were so starstruck while you're talking to De Vera.
Yeah, I have loved the census for a long time. Starting when I was like 8 years old, my mom would get me the Guinness Book of World Records at Costco. You know how they have that big book table? Great place. The Guinness Book of World Records has a ton of records in it. And the ones that I was always interested in were like most people at this thing, most people at that thing. And I got pretty good at guesstimating how many people are in an arena or how many people are at a protest and all that kind of stuff. I'm just always interested in why people are where they are and how they got there and how long they've been there and things like that. In college, I studied geographic information systems and geography, and we use census data in order to create a lot of the maps in this country and another survey called the American Community Survey. So speaking with De Vera was a true dream of mine. I even, before COVID happened, signed up to be a part-time census enumerator, and I got the job, but then it was delayed because of COVID. But that would have meant that I would be knocking on your door and telling you to fill out the census. So I mourn the loss of that.
I feel like this episode, when we originally came up with the idea for counter programming, our first thought was like, okay, countertops, of course. And then I feel like the census was one of the ones that you kept bringing up as like, we're going to do an episode on this.
Yeah. And it's everything that we've dreamed of. This interview is truly amazing. We're talking about it so much because we really think you're going to learn so much and that you're going to be census advocates. Right after you hear this, you're going to go knock on doors, even though you don't have to, make people fill out that census. It's so cool to be counted. I mean it.
I mean, I filled out the census, but I admire your enthusiasm.
I feel like the way people feel about their favorite football team is the way I feel about the census in general.
Go census.
Yes, exactly. Like, I used to think I'll never care about anything as much as like my ex-boyfriends in high school cared about their favorite football team. But I feel about the census, I think, more so than they felt about the New York Jets.
Okay. We are so pumped to finally reveal this interview that we have hyped up with census expert Farrah Cohen. We're going to take a short ad break, though. Sorry to leave you on a cliffhanger. And then you'll get to hear the interview.
Finally.
Finally. Hi, counties. You've heard it before, but we'll say it again. We are in weird, unprecedented times.
Ugh, remember precedented times? Miss ya, precedented times.
One of the podcasts that's been helping us make sense of the hubbub is the Super Politics Podcast, hosted by Steve and Decatur, a lawyer and a hip-hop producer, respectively. Super Politics Podcasts break down today's major political questions.
As we continue to stay engaged and informed on the political discourse, Super Politics Podcast will guide you through. Steve and Decatur discuss what people disagree about and why, and give you all of the correct answers. It's the leftist politics podcast of your dreams.
In their most recent episode, Cop Out, Steve and Decatur discuss police reform and the discussions happening surrounding that issue around the country. I've really been trying to educate myself on what a defunded police system will look like, so this was super helpful to me.
All aboard the truth train.
Choo-choo.
Shira, you even did that with your arm. Listen to the Super Politics Podcast wherever you're listening to our show right now.
Okay, Arielle, we're back. And let's now give the counties what they want. It's interview time.
We made you wait long enough, but here it is. We are so excited to welcome Devera Cohn to Counter Programming. Devera, we're going to read your bio so that our listeners know who we're dealing with and the expert that we're dealing with. Shira, go ahead.
Devera Cohn is a senior writer and editor at Pew Research Center. She studies and writes about demographics in the United States, especially the census. Cohn was a Washington Post reporter for 21 years, mainly writing about demographics, and was the newspaper's lead reporter for the 2000 census. Before joining Pew Research Center, she served as a consultant and freelance writer for the Brookings Institution and Population Reference Bureau. Cohn is a graduate of Bryn Mawr College and is a former Nieman Fellow. She's an author of studies on the marriage and birth rates in the United States, migration between the U.S. and Mexico, and U.S. population projections. Cohn manages Pew Research Center's At All Things Census Twitter account. She has spoken at national journalism conferences about how reporters can make use of demographic data in stories and often talks about the center's findings in print and broadcast media.
Hi, thanks for having me. One little fact about me that you might not know is this is actually the fourth census that I've covered either as a journalist or a researcher at Pew Research Center. So I can out-nerd you on the census any day.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's very exciting. Devera, your work is right up my alley. For the listeners who don't know, I studied geography in college and I'm obsessed with the census and with numbers and demographics and how all of that shakes out in everyday life. So I am so excited to welcome you here. We're so happy that we found you and that you agreed to chat with us today. Let's jump right in.
Perfect. So I am not as much of a census buff as Arielle, but I did fill out my census form this year. So that was very exciting. And obviously, we know this census year is coming at a particularly challenging time with coronavirus and now unrest in multiple cities across the U.S. in response to the death of George Floyd and countless other people in the Black community. So as a census expert, are you worried that the numbers will be skewed by these factors?
Well, even before all this happened, the census had a challenge reaching communities of color. The census has historically undercounted African Americans and Latinos in particular, as well as American Indians and some of the Asian Pacific Hawaiian Islanders. Less so Asians as a group, although some particular subgroups of Asians are undercounted. So the census already was facing these challenges when the coronavirus hit. And they had to suspend the field work that they were doing, the face-to-face kind of operations, a lot of them designed to build enthusiasm for the census. They're only now, as we speak in June, restarting these. And so we'll see whether they're able to make up for lost time. And then, as you pointed out, some of the social unrest in urban areas especially has force them to close some census offices, although I think they're reopening them. So, you know, we'll see whether they can compensate for the problems that the virus has thrust upon them. On the plus side, what's called self-response rate, which is the percentage of households that responded to the census on their own without waiting for someone to knock on the door, has actually exceeded their projections so far. Now, maybe that's because they've been stuck at home and this gives them something to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'd love it if you could give us a little bit of history surrounding the census. How has it changed over the years in the U.S. as more advanced technology has come about?
Yeah, well, the first census was in 1790, as many people know, and was carried out by federal marshals on horseback going door to door. And even then, there was concern that there may have been an undercount, that they may not have reached everyone who they should have. Back then, there were only a few categories of person who were actually counted and named. And of course, as some may know, slaves were only counted as 3/5 of a person, which was a compromise designed to give the South some political power beyond which might have deserved, but less than it wanted. through the years, actually, you talk about technology. The Census Bureau actually has been at the forefront of a lot of new technology, including really sponsoring the first real computers from a young man who later went on to found IBM. And technology has increased and increased over the years to the point that this census is the first one where they're encouraging most people to respond online.
Yeah, this is definitely the first one that I've done online. I remember in 2010 filling it out, sitting next to my grandpa in White Plains, New York. And I guess in 2000, I was only 8, so I don't remember that one. But it is fun to think back to our memories with the census. Shira, do you have any memories with it?
I imagine my mom, in 2010, my mom would have filled it out for our whole house together. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have had to do it. But this year, all three of my roommates and I got paper copies of it. And then I filled it out for our household online. But it was confusing because we were getting so much mail. But I don't remember doing it in 2010. And I guess we would have.
You were 7 in 2000. Yeah. So it's an interesting tradition that goes back. And I guess that brings me to another question, which is I filled it out with my housemates. I live with two other women who are in their mid to late 20s. And we're all moving in the next month. Shira, you had the same question.
I had the same thought. I was so worried. I like read 20 times to make sure we were actually supposed to fill it out together.
Right, right. So, Devera, can you speak to that at all?
Well, yeah, there are a couple of things that come to mind. One is, you know, you talked about young people such as yourself and filling out your own form. And one of the things we found in our surveys is that younger adults tend to know a little bit less about the census than older groups. And one reason for that is, you know, often this may be their first census that they filled out on their own. So, you know, it's to be expected that they have to find out more before they fill it out. But what the census is supposed to be is a snapshot on April 1 of where everyone is living. So if you move after April 1, you're supposed to be counted where you are on April 1, which this year is actually a huge issue for college students because a lot of campuses shut down, young people moved home or somewhere else, and you're supposed to be counted as a student where your campus housing is. So if you live in a dorm, you're supposed to be counted there. If you live in off-campus housing in the college town, counted there. If you live with your folks, you're counted there. But a lot of people were confused and the Census Bureau had to put out a special statement and saying, no, you're counted where you'd normally live and sleep on April 1, which is at your college address.
I saw that article that you wrote about college students and where they're counted. And we'll definitely link to that in the show notes so that people can check it out.
I didn't realize that about college students because we didn't have a census when we were in college. It's so interesting. So let's shift gears then and talk about how you ended up in this field and how you became passionate about it.
Yeah, like a lot of life, it actually was a bit of an accident. I was working as a journalist at the Washington Post in 1990, and the Census Bureau put out some statistics, and the editors needed somebody to help put a story together, so they threw a couple of us into that. And afterward, having realized that there was a lot more of this coming along, I sent a note to the editor saying, "You're going to need somebody to start focusing on this." And he said, "Thank you for volunteering." So as it turned out, I knew a little bit more math than most journalists, which is not saying much.
Oh, that's good.
Most journalists, you know, say I didn't go into journalism to do math, but I had a year of statistics, I don't know, a decade earlier at a fellowship program that I was in the Nieman Fellowship that you mentioned. And it gave me a tiny bit of confidence that I actually could handle stories about data. And I love data because you can say things with it that you can't say with anecdotes. More than interviewing one or two people who tell you something, you actually have the numbers to prove it or disprove it. If somebody has an idea about something that's going on, you can say, well, the data show the opposite. So kind of hugged that close to me for decades, the idea that data can really be a fun way to provide narrative about what's going on in people's lives.
Numbers are great. So are facts. Tell that to our president. I have a question for you about what is the difference between the Census Bureau and the Pew Research Center? How do they both deal with demographic data?
Well, of course, the Census Bureau is a government agency and we're a nonprofit private research organization. You know, the census surveys everybody. That's the wonderful thing about it. It's supposed to be counting everybody who's living in the U.S., everyone aside from foreign business travelers or tourists who were there on April 1 is supposed to be counted. Well, of course, we do a lot of survey work at Pew Research, and we rely on the census for what's called the sampling frame. That is, the census tells you how many people there are in the country, but also how many are in each sort of subgroup, it's called, like of different ages, racial and ethnic categories, income, education, and so forth. And we take that data as gospel truth and trying to have a representative sample in our surveys of the entire adult population of the U.S. So when we survey 1,000 people, for example, and we say that that's representative, we know that it is because it echoes what the Census Bureau has told us about the makeup of the total population.
That makes so much sense.
So with the historically that groups of color are undercounted, maybe rural areas are undercounted, how does the Census Bureau compensate for those undercounts? Do they look to past demographic data and try to extrapolate that?
Well, first of all, we know there's an undercount because the census does research after the census is taken to match up both what's known from existing birth records and tax records and some other data with the total population they counted. And they also do a survey, a second survey, independent from the census, to make sure to see who was counted and who wasn't. So they have a pretty solid base of research showing, you know, what they missed and who they overcounted, by the way. White,
oh, wow.
White non-Hispanic folks tend to be overcounted more than once. So how do they try to compensate? Well, one big thing is they spend lots of money on advertising and outreach. They put ads all over the place, on the sides of buses, on radio, TV, websites, promotional material that they pass out at rallies. But guess what? Because of the virus, a lot of those in-person events that might have helped are being put off or done online instead. So to some extent, they've been able to pivot by producing promotional materials to give out at food banks, or people can make masks out of census t-shirts and those kinds of things. But that's only so far that'll get you, and we'll see whether it's enough to make up for what has been, you know, a really robust advertising and outreach campaign.
How is the Census Bureau and I guess the Pew Research Center finding the data so far coming in? So April 1st was the day that people were supposed to start filling out their census forms. And now we are here. June 9th is the day of our recording. Can you already tell that there is an undercount or that people are not filling out the census?
Well, by some measures, the census is doing very well. They had set a target of 60.5% self-response from households that got mailings or forms, and they've already exceeded that. And the number will probably go up even more by the time they start knocking on doors in August. So that is good. But there are groups that, particularly I'm thinking of some folks at the City University of New York, that have done some analysis of the kinds of census tracts or neighborhoods where people are over-responding or under-responding. And as is true in the past, census tracts that tend to have a large share of communities of color, again, especially African Americans and Latinos, tend to be not responding at the same rate as census tracts or neighborhoods with high shares of whites. So that's an issue of concern. And they found some similar kinds of patterns regarding age and poverty and that sort of thing. So that means that there'll still be a challenge to the Bureau when they start sending folks to go knocking on doors. The good news in terms of the self-response is the higher the self-response is, the fewer door knockers the Census Bureau will have to hire, so the less work it'll have to try to reach people. But mm-hmm. It does seem, again, from this other data, that the same groups that have been hard to count in the past are going to be hard to count this year.
This is more of a tangent, but the census, the people who go to knock on the doors, it's not like when you're getting someone to sign a petition to get a candidate on a ballot, they can't have you fill it out in front of them, can they? Or like, well, they collect it? It's more of a, you have to do, they just tell you to do it.
So anyone who works for the census, and this is actually a point worth making, anybody who works for the census takes a lifetime oath of confidentiality under a law that's known as Title 13. It's the number of the law. And it essentially says that when people give you information about themselves, that then becomes part of the census statistics, you cannot reveal that information. In fact, a former census director used to say, you know, you've never seen Elvis's census form, have you? And you could probably say it of just about any other famous person. But point is, that oath means that whatever somebody tells you, and they often give you that kind of confidential information, you as a census taker can't reveal it. And census numbers are confidential for 72 years. So the stuff that they're collecting now, I think it's 2092, you know, stick around and you'll be able to see it.
So we will eventually be able to see Elvis's census records.
Yeah, exactly. And actually in 2022, the 1950 census will come out. So people who were around in 1950 are already looking forward to that.
Wow.
It's a great, census data is a great tool for family genealogists, people trying to trace their roots and all of that, you know, and it's also a lot of fun if you're trying to see where famous people used to live.
So what's your message to someone who says, it doesn't matter, I'm not going to fill out the census this year? I feel like we heard that.
So my role here is, you know, we're not at Pew Research Center, we're not advocates, although we love the census data, we want it to be good and we want it to be complete. But of course, my role is not to tell folks, fill out your forms, but I can go into a little bit, why is the census important? You know, why
yes,
do we
please.
Do it at all, right? One is, well, it's in the Constitution, and the Constitution says that we count people to allocate or apportion the number of seats in Congress in the U.S. House that each state gets. So that's one very important use. It also is used to redraw the political boundaries within states, so congressional districts, city council districts, all of those. So it helps allocate political power. It also distributes a lot of money, an estimated at least $1.5 trillion with a T dollars a year in federal funding for all kinds of programs, many of them social services, but also related to emergency planning, where schools are located, where roads are built, all of that come from census numbers. And then, of course, they're also used to just tell us who we are for research purposes, for business decisions, and for a wide variety of other uses. So a lot of the advocates who promote the census talk about how, you know, it's a way of standing up and being heard and making your community heard.
Shira and I are definitely advocates for the census. You can't say you are, but we will. So that brings us pretty seamlessly to my next question, which is, can you give us an example of a time that census data has showed a direct action? So, for example, a different seat reapportionment or a community getting a park or something like that?
Well, this is a kind of older story, but it's worth telling. So there certainly are a lot of examples in different communities of how census numbers help direct services and schools and that sort of thing. But in some years ago, in 2000, I believe it was, there was a court case that involved the last seat to be allocated in Congress based on census numbers. And there was a very small difference between two states, Utah and North Carolina. Sorry, that would have been 1990. And North Carolina got the seat based on the fact that it had a relatively small number more people than Utah did. And Utah filed suit saying, on a number of grounds, but one of them was, we think that the missionaries from the Mormon Church who are abroad also ought to be counted in the census, and that would bring our numbers up. And this case went to the Supreme Court, and there were a lot of issues that the court was looking at. And in the end, the seat went to North Carolina. So the difference between the two states was relatively small, a few thousand or a few hundred people. And I guess it just goes to show you that a few people can really make a difference in how political power is allocated or many other things.
Yeah. So definitely to those who say, I'm not going to fill it out, it doesn't really matter. It does. It really does. We advocate for it.
How do you see the census changing in the coming decades with factors like technology and just changing demographics and hopefully making the process more inclusive to communities of color?
That is a great question. Because there's been a lot of talk about it. This may not sound like it goes directly to your point, but there's been a lot of talk about how the existing way of doing the census may be broken because, like all surveys, the census is finding it just harder and harder to get people to respond. It's got to put out more and more effort to get people to reply. And to some extent, you know, then that costs more and more money. So what they're trying this time is increased use of what's called administrative records. So those are records that the government might have or might be in private sector databases about you. So it might be your social security record. It might be your tax record. In the case of immigrants, and this is a little controversial, it might be your Homeland Security immigration file or file from the State Department. And the Census Bureau is using those records in a somewhat limited way in the census this time. But there's a lot of talk about how in future censuses by 2030, that perhaps it'll be a much more expanded role for these other sets of records, those that are accurate. Now, the drawback is that only about 90% of the population can be counted accurately with those kinds of records. And the 10% that can't be counted accurately tends to be the same groups that are hard to reach anyway. So there's a bit of a tension there. But this issue is being played out as we speak, and we'll see where it goes.
Amazing. I have a question about what happens between, for example, 2020 and 2030. So I imagine after the census is finished, after this year of collecting the data is finished, maybe there's 3 to 4 years of analyzing the data. What happens then between, say, 2024 and 2027? What are the people doing in the office?
Yeah. You know, the Census Bureau gets a little frustrated because people in Congress who supply the money and other folks think that they tend to sleep between censuses. First of all, they do a lot of other work. They have numerous other surveys going on, including those that help us decide how much unemployment there is in the country, and surveys that tell us a lot of patterns about education, immigration, income, all kinds of other information, business decisions. So they're doing all this other work, but there's also a lot of planning that goes into the census. The life cycle of the 2020 census actually began back in 2013 or so with planning based on what lessons they'd learned from the 2010 census. So there's a lot of work that goes into putting together the next big count.
I think I want to work for the census. I actually know I want to work for the census. I've tried many times. There's the Population Foundation in Silver Springs, Maryland. I've applied there a few times. So you'll see me there soon in DC, Devera.
Okay. We'll be happy to go to lunch if we ever can do that again.
Aw, I'd love that.
So you've been on 4 different censuses now.
Cycles, I guess.
Census cycles. I was going to say campaign, so I was like, that's definitely not the right word. Do you see a lot of the same faces at the Census Bureau? Like, are similar people running the show? Do they try to change it up each cycle so that there's like just new ideas? How does that work?
Well, so most of the census employees, all but a handful, are civil servants. So they are often people who've worked at the Bureau for many years. Now, the leadership at the top tends to change some, partly because doing a census is exhausting work and people are often ready to retire afterward.
Now, put me in, coach.
There you go. Yeah, offer yourself up and, you know, they may be interested. Now, at the top, the census director job is a political job. So that changes depending on the administration. Although, there is now a 10-year term for the Census Bureau director. The last person who held the job, however, did leave before that term was up. So there is turnover. Yeah,
And the reason for the 10-year is so that they span potentially 2 presidential cycles?
It was intended to try to depoliticize the census. Mm. It hasn't entirely worked, but that was the goal.
Yeah, and I guess that brings us to this year. To this cycle with the citizenship question. So this year with the citizen question, there was some speculation that having a citizenship question on the census would deter some communities from participating. First, can you tell us a little bit about the citizenship question and how it eventually got struck down? And also what initial reports are suggesting for immigrant communities?
Sure. So the Trump administration proposed to include a question of everyone on the census about citizenship, asking whether they were a citizen or not, if they were born abroad, were they a naturalized citizen? So this immediately became controversial. There were numerous lawsuits by a variety of both state governments and advocacy groups against this on numerous grounds, one of them being that one of the challenges was, well, people aren't going to fill out the form if this question is there. But then there were objections on grounds of process and procedure, contending that the administration had gone about putting this question on the census in a way that was against the law. And that eventually reached the Supreme Court in July of last year, in 2019. And the court ruled, in fact, that the reason that the administration gave for adding the question seemed, in Chief Justice Roberts' words, contrived. So they gave the administration a chance to offer another reason, but the administration said, no, it's too late in the process. We'll take it off. And instead, we will collect information about citizenship by other means. And so the president signed an executive order ordering the Census Bureau to collect, use other data, these administrative records from government agencies or private data, to collect the citizenship status of every American by other means and report that out alongside the census, but not as part of it. So will this discourage people from answering the census? You know, we took a couple of surveys and we found actually that most people did not know that there wasn't a census question about citizenship. People either thought it was on the form or they weren't sure. And then we tried as hard as we could to see whether there was any link between that answer and willingness to answer the census. We couldn't really draw a direct link. The best we could say was the more somebody knows about the census, both what it asks and its uses and so forth, the more likely that person is to say that they probably will respond. So we couldn't draw that direct link, but certainly advocates have been saying that, and some other surveys have been put out that make that claim. You know, we'll have to see.
Yeah. And of course, the irony of it is that the census is anonymous. So if you mark that you're not a citizen, that's okay. But there is a fear and a lack of knowledge that kind of would cause some people to not want to fill it out entirely.
You know, I was just reading a newspaper account from Arkansas by a historian who was writing that. He was looking around in some records from 1920 when German immigrants were expressing fear that if they answered the census, they would be deported. So this issue, I guess, has come up in the past as well.
Yeah. And I guess we're going to try to wrap it up soon, although I wish we could talk forever. I have a million questions and questions that have stemmed from my questions. But to bring it back to our podcast, which is Counter Programming, each episode we talk about a different type of counter. Today, of course, people counters, the census. Devera, can you share with us any bit of history of the census? So what's the earliest census that you know of? What kind of counting methods were first used, I guess?
Well, I think one of the interesting things to say about the census now and in the past is that in back through history, the uses of the census were usually very targeted. So for example, you wanted to know how many young men there were so you could raise an army if need be.
Oh, wow.
In fact, that was one of the earlier questions on the U.S. census was it broke out men by age for the purpose of knowing, you know, what your military force could be. Or you might want to know something about people's wealth so that you could tax them. And the difference between then and now is that now we really want to know how the census is designed more to serve people. That is, what are the needs of people and how can we use the census to determine that? So when I mentioned, for example, that the census is used to disperse or help guide the disbursement of more than $1.5 trillion of federal funding each year, that funding goes for programs, a lot of them to help people in need, social services, feeding, health, and that sort of thing. So the census is being used more as a tool to help people than to extract something from them. And that's been a big change over time.
Wow.
Before we wrap up, is there anything you want us to ask or anything else you want to share with
our fun facts? Do you have any favorite census facts?
Any favorite census facts? Well, okay. So one thing that is sort of relevant to the discussion we were having earlier about undercounted communities is that I mentioned that the census does research and it knows that it undercounts folks. But some of this in the early days when the census was only discovering by accident how it undercounts people, there's one statistic that really illuminates that very well. And that is that in World War II, when the draft began, the government discovered that there were something like 13% more young Black men registering for the draft than had been counted in the census. And this set off a rather interesting, you know, sort of chain reaction to, oh, why is that? You know, and it helped set in motion a lot of today's research that we that we have on undercounted populations, how they're undercounted, and what the government might be able to do to address that issue.
Thank you. A fact that is not necessarily fun, but necessary. We love it. Thank you, Devera.
Thank you so much, Devera, for joining us today. I know our counties are, that's what we call our counter-programming fans. We know our counties are going to love this information about people counters, and hopefully it will shed some light on the census for everyone. I know I am not as well versed as Ariel, so I learned a lot from speaking with you today.
And I learned so much from speaking with you too. It is such an honor. I kind of was starstruck at a few points, but we're going to cut all those points out of the actual recording.
we'll keep one or two in, Ariel.
Yeah, just for fun. Thank you for your time. We will link to all of your articles and your Twitter handle in the show notes so that people can make sure to check out what you're working on.
Great. It was lovely to meet both of you virtually.
Hopefully we'll meet in person one day soon.
Lunch in Washington, D.C.
Someday. Yes, when you're working for the Census Bureau.
That's right.
I'll come down and visit.
We truly had so many more questions for Devera. We could have gone all day. We hope this interview was inspiring for you, counties, and that if you haven't already, you fill out that census. Imagine me saying that with like the clap emojis between each word. Fill out that census. They get it. In order to do that, just go to 2020census.gov. That's 2020census.gov and tell them we sent you. Just kidding. You don't have to do that. We don't get any credit for it.
Ariel, there were really a few times during that interview where I thought you were going to pass out. You were so excited to be talking to Devera, as was I. But
you could see the blood leaving my face.
Yeah. I hope you guys get your coffee date in D.C. one day soon.
I was really starstruck. The counties don't know this, but they should. I had to write in to our script to avoid saying wow every time I was amazed by something, because I did do that with our interview with Arye. If you listen back, I said wow, I think 15 times. And listening to it back for me was terrible, but I hope that for the counties, you just picked up on how excited we were.
As Devera said, we'll get access to this year's census in 72 years. I'll be the ripe old age of 99. So let's all plan to meet back here then to discuss.
Sounds like a plan. Before we started taping, Devera mentioned that Sesame Street actually does some promo for the census. And so there's an amazing clip on YouTube that I found that brings together Count Von Count, if you remember from one of our earlier episodes, and this current episode, People Counters or the Census, where the count actually instructs people on how to fill out the census, and we want to play that clip for you. Here it is.
Ah, the census, my favorite time of the decade.
Census, what's that?
Oh, it is a special time when we count each person in every home in all the neighborhoods across the country. One monster of Sesame Street.
Do kids count?
Of course. Everyone in your home counts, especially little kids and babies. One, two. Two little kids.
But why do we count everyone?
Ah, great question. Counting everyone in your home helps support your neighborhood for the next 10 years by funding things like schools, hospitals, and buses. So count yourself and everyone in your home. In 10 minutes, you can complete the census by calling or going online or return your form by mail.
It's easy, secure, and most important, it's totally private.
Make your family count!
This year, make sure every child counts. Visit 2020census.gov.
How freaking perfect! Again, since it's so important, if you haven't yet, fill out that census and talk to your coworkers, friends, and neighbors about it.
Counties, what a lovely episode, if we do say so ourselves. We've really been around the counter world with this podcast. Kitchens, exercise, coins, and now people counting? What shall we cover next, Shira?
Okay, Ariel. Well, I recently discovered that the Negroni, which has like really had a resurgence during quarantine, was created by Count Negroni.
Better yet, when did he create it?
He created it during the last major pandemic, the Spanish flu, in the early 1900s.
I mean, it's serendipitous.
Yeah, I think we have to, if you're okay with that.
I am, and we will get to Olaf, we promise.
Yeah, it's just when we found this out, it was like, oh, what? Oh, we not?
Olaf's on the back burner for now, so for the people who are only coming for Olaf, I'm sorry, but Negroni should get you. And we plan on doing some really fun recording for the Negroni. We want to create Negronis. We're going to drink them beforehand, so we might be a little drunk during our next episode. Ooh, and just so everybody knows, we record at 10 a.m. on Saturday. So it'll be fun.
It's 1 p.m. in New York, so I'm fine.
Yeah, you're fine. That's okay to drink. It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yeah. All right, counties, we're heading out. But before we do, we need your voice. At the beginning of this episode, you heard our friend Zeri. She sounded like a beautiful public radio goddess.
You can be that type of famous, too. All you have to do is record a voice clip on your phone and send it to counterprogrammingshiraariel@gmail.com. Shira, what should that voice clip sound like?
Hi, I'm, insert your name here, recording from where you're recording from, and you're listening to Counter Programming with Shira and Ariel. And don't be afraid to give it your own flair, too.
We love flair. Great job, Shira.
Thank you. Let's wrap it up. Thank you to our guest, the brilliant Devera Cohn. We loved learning about people counters, aka the census, with you. Make sure you check out the show notes where we'll link to all of Devera's articles and her Twitter. She's very Twitter famous, BGW.
She really is. She has like 16,000 followers and she only follows like a few hundred people. That ratio is on point. Thank you, as always, to our amazing sound engineer, Daniel Turek. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Find his work and get in touch at robotslap.com. He is the one in charge of all these perfectly placed sound effects.
Our music is by Jason Shaw. The song is called Tennessee Hayride, and we love it.
Kaio Slikta is the dude who designed our logo. I know he made it a while ago, and we've had it for a long time, but sometimes I find myself staring at it for hours on end. You can find him and get your own design to stare at for hours on end by going to Instagram. He's at Kaio Slikta. That's CAIOSLIKTA.
We'll catch you next week, counties.
Bye, Shira.
Bye, Ariel.
Bye, counties.
I think we nailed it that time.
I have no idea.
Bye, counties.